Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Ahoy, mateys! Ahoy! What a lucky lot of rascals ye are! Not only have ye washed up on the shores of the Tattered Cover as we celebrate our 40th year afloat, ye just happen to make land on talk like a pirate day. Arr! Aye, and to celebrate, the scribe of the number 7 New York Times bestseller, Pirate King, has quite a party planned. But our lady does not know that our buccaneers have had their telescopes trained on her and have discovered that today is Larry R. King's birthday. So, as Larry makes her way to this here masthead, would you all please join me in a serenade? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Larry. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming out to the Tattered Cover. I'm hoping you're less tattered feeling by the end of this evening. So what I thought I might do is just talk for a few minutes about Pirate King, as if it were a serious novel and you all need to know the background of it. I will then open it to questions and I will answer them probably with equal nonsense. And I, at the end of it, if you're still willing to hear my voice, I'll read you a bedtime story and you can all leave, having bought your book first from the Tattered Cover. So I have written 10 different versions of Mary Russell's memoirs. And the last two of them, The Language of Bees and God of the Hive, had begun to get not really serious. They weren't really dark, but they were much more along the lines of straightforward suspense novels. And in fact, God of the Hive was almost a thriller. The way it was constructed was very thriller-esque. You have multiple viewpoints. You have, including the villain's point of view, you have this time-sensitive issue. Much more a thriller than, for example, The Beekeeper's Apprentice. In the early books, there is a degree of whimsy that I felt had been sort of left behind. Now, part of that is that, of course, in the early books, Russell is very young. And so you have that kind of energy, which when you're 24, it's not quite the same as being 15. However, when my editor, we have these yearly conversations with what I'm going to do next. And normally, I try and alternate a Russell Holmes with something that isn't a Russell Holmes, either a Martinelli or a standalone. But with Language of Bees and God of the Hive, they were linked by the fact that I wrote that sentence at the very end of Language of Bees, which I never, ever will publish a book with that sentence in again, to be continued. The fact that that was there made it necessary to do two in a row, because I think people would have lynched me. They would have made me walk the plank. And although walking the plank is lovely if you're in the Caribbean and the water's warm, you know, it's also, well, so I thought, when we had this conversation for the third time in a row, and my editor said, I'd really like you to do another Russell. Normally, I would have said, absolutely not. But I thought, well, I'd kind of like to do a Russell that is extremely different from the last two. Let's do something that is a farce. And when I said this to her, she looked at me like, oh dear, Laurie's really lost it this time. But I said, no, no, it'll work fine. We'll have Gilbert and Sullivan. And she said, what? I said, no, no, honestly, it'll work great. And maybe we'll have pirates. And she said, what about a Martinelli? However, I was already off in the direction of Gilbert and Sullivan and silent movie films and all the rest of it. So I decided that what I would do with it was to make it one of those books that picks up on the thing that Russell occasionally says in the various other books, where she mentions that it's extremely odd sometimes to know that her husband is regarded as being a fictional character, and that it sometimes makes her feel slightly fictional and transparent. This kind of interesting little metafiction that goes on in these. And I thought, what if I really, really amped that up? So this book is a Laurie King novel, which is a Mary Russell memoir, which is a 1924 film project, a movie, motion picture project, silent films, of course, that is about a film project, that is about the Pirates of Penzance. So as I'm looking at all these levels of the story and wondering if I can possibly keep them straight, I also happened to be going to Lisbon. And I spent several weeks there. My daughter was living there for a while. And so I thought, well, I the only equipment I need is my laptop, and so I can write in Lisbon as easily as I can in California. So I went off to Lisbon, and as I looked around the city, I thought, this would be a very interesting place for Russell to come and look at. So I'm doing my research, and I come across this individual named Fernando Pessoa. Now, have any of you ever heard of Fernando Pessoa other than in Laurie King's books and blogs? One? Now, how do you know him? You're an English professor. No. Okay. Yes. So you are, I think, the one person in 2 weeks' worth of events who's actually heard of Fernando Pessoa. One other woman had, and she worked in a bookstore, which I thought, not really the same thing. Fernando Pessoa regarded himself as the poet laureate of Portugal, although he was almost entirely unpublished in his lifetime. He regarded Portugal as being on the cutting edge of art in the 20th century, even though Portugal at the time was rather busy with a revolution. So he was this man who had many ideas about how the world worked that weren't necessarily how the rest of the world agreed with him, including his idea of poetry and how a poet is judged to be best, is not that you write formal poetry, but that you write the character. So that Shakespeare was great and all that, but Shakespeare would have been better if, instead of writing plays, he had created the characters and turned the characters loose on the stage. Don't think too closely, John. Pessoa's poetry takes the place of, he has 72 different, what he calls, heteronyms, which are not just pseudonyms, they are fully developed personalities. 72 of them, 72 individuals living in that little man's head. And he would occasionally, become those people, so that if he, you know, was talking to a friend, there would be times when they weren't quite sure who it was they were talking to. And you can imagine, I came across Fernando Pessoa, who was in Lisbon in 24, and I thought, I really need to have this character in my book. No one will believe that I didn't make him up, but I need to have him in there. So, okay, Fernando Pessoa, involved in this film group with Mary Russell and various people who may or may not be criminal as well. And they decide that the director decides that he has to hire some men who look more like pirates than the usual English actors. So Pessoa takes them down on the docks to hire men who look like pirates. And the reader begins to get the idea that they may not just look like pirates. So that's how the book sets off. When I was in Lisbon, my daughter and her husband and I decided to have 10 days off somewhere else, and we looked at various places, but it was still sort of springtime, so we thought, let's head south. And we went to Morocco, which is a fabulous country, absolutely amazing country. And as I was looking at the potential places that we could visit in Morocco, I came across a small city on the coast called Saleh, which was also the kingdom of Bou Regreg, which was a pirate kingdom. So, you know, this book embraces all those things. And so here we are singing about pirates and eating a cake that has pirates on it. So that's sort of where Pirate King comes from. I don't want to talk about it in any great detail because I'm hoping that you will read it and enjoy it. And if I tell you what happens, that you won't enjoy it because you'll say, she gave it away. So do you have any questions or comments that you'd like me to rattle on about? Yeah.
What's the most difficult part about sort of researching the time? Because, you know, it's set back kind of far. Not too bad, but...
Well, it's... You know, the 20s are really not bad when it comes to research. The question is, what's the most difficult part of researching the 20s? The advantage of that time is that there's a lot of material, both written and photographic, and there's even a lot of magazines and that sort of thing, the ephemeral stuff. But it's far enough back so that there's not a whole lot of people who remember it really well, who can argue with you about it. Which is a real advantage. You know, if you start writing about the 50s and 60s, you say to people, oh, no, that really, no, people didn't do that then. But in the 20s, they say, oh, well, maybe, I guess, I don't know. So it's much easier to lie and cheat. You know, that there's, I think capturing the essence of the time is the trickiest bit, because you can pick up language and you can pick up technology through... you know, just research, but to try and capture the essence of what the 20s felt like. The thing that comes to mind is fiction, because with fiction you have people such as Dorothy Sayers who's writing that kind of dialogue. But you have to be careful because pretty soon you end up stealing from Dorothy Sayers and people notice. So it's, you know, I find the 20s an appealing time to research. I don't need to put footnotes in my things, but I could. In the back.
How do you write so many different styles? It's like you're so many different writers.
The question is how do I write in so many styles? Well, you see, Fernando Pessoa and I, No, really, that's not the same. Yes, really, it is. I I think that I was particularly blessed when I first started writing to start with this character of Mary Russell, because she was a very strong voice, and I met her early in my career. She was I had played with a novel some years before, which later became Califia's Daughters, but the first crime story that I wrote was The Beekeeper's Apprentice. And Russell really walked onto the page in a way that few characters have since. Mostly when you're writing characters, you think about it longer, of what you need and how they interact with the time, and what is the setting. So that with the Martinelli books, for example, I wanted her to be a professional, so I had to sort of figure out how would she best do her job, where would she be doing it, pick a city that's large enough to justify a series of homicides. I mean, you know, most cities don't really require the use of a full team of homicide inspectors. But with Russell, she just was there, and that was particularly... I was particularly fortunate. Being in the first person, I think it's easier to write differently in her voice than others, because the other ones are all third person, and really the Martinellis and the standalones are somewhat similar in language, in use of language. I think the standalones tend to be more formal novels, and the Martinellis tend to be simpler English, that more straightforward. But that's the kind of thing that comes along with, you know, the shaping the book and the rewrite. It's what you're trying to make the book do. But with the Russells, because she is who she is, she's this older woman looking back at a rich life, and she's highly educated and rather pompous. And she uses language that they didn't even use in the 20s. I mean, she speaks a very formal British English. So I actually make use of a thesaurus with Russell just to help me enrich the language. You know, I think about vocabulary a lot more with the Russell books than I do the others. So, yeah. Yeah, I would like to do... I always envision Califia's Daughters as a middle in a trilogy. And I would like to do those, but... You know, I find I can write a book a year. And if I have a contract for writing a book, it means that I can have a house to live in while I'm writing. Whereas if I'm writing just on the side, My car is too small. Yeah.
The last several books are all taking place in 1924. Are you going to give Holmes and Russell a bit of a break?
The question is, you mean, am I going to go and write a different book, or?
They've all, like, the last, I don't know how many books were all in 1924.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They're right after another. She
has noted that the last eight books have all been in a 15-month period. Part of the problem is that if you have a protagonist, one of the protagonists is getting on in years, you don't want to stretch things out too long. So I probably will continue to give them more or less back-to-back cases. I mean, it's much more interesting to drive the poor woman crazy, too. I mean, she just settles down to her books, and off she goes again. the next book that I'm doing, that I have, until I had my conversation with my editor last week, I thought I had the next two books settled, and now she's thrown something else into the mix, so I have to think about that. But what I plan to do, the next two books, and the one is almost finished. I'm working at the final stages of the rewrite. Is actually a fourth Russell in a row. It's because I couldn't bear to have them just go to this one small town of Saleh in Morocco. And I, the thought of letting 2 years go by before I came back to writing about Fez was just intolerable. So when my editor very gingerly said, I don't suppose you'd want to do another Russell, I said, okay. Which she, the sound of her falling to the floor in New York. but it's a book where Russell gets involved in the Reef War that's going on in 1924 in the northern part of Morocco, and it's mostly in Fez, which is the most incredible city in the world. If you ever get a chance to go to Fez, do not pass it up. It's a medieval city with internet cafes. Not that the internet works, you understand, but... Yeah.
You did a masterful job of foreshadowing in the last Martinelli book and with the intersection of the manuscript and her getting her information that everything that she had heard was indeed true. Are they going to cross paths?
The question is about the last Martinelli book with the intersecting storylines of the manuscript and poor Martinelli. I don't know if they will ever cross paths. When my editor asked me for that book, which became The Art of Detection, I think she had in mind something, a more active meeting. And I said, you want me to have a 110-year-old Mary Russell arrested for murder in San Francisco? It's never too late. You know? But I think that it's going to be a little tricky to get the two storylines to intersect any. The bigger question would be the book that I'm writing after the Fez book is supposed to be a sequel to Touchstone, because I really liked the characters and I thought, you know, Touchstone really should have been the first in a series, not a long series. I don't think it's going to have, you know, 12 volumes of it, but maybe four set between the wars in Europe. So, of course, you've got 1926 as the first one, as Touchstone, and I probably will do the next one, 28 or 9, in Paris. But, of course, you begin to get into the whole question of will Stuyvesant and the rest of them ever come across Russell and Holmes? And I think the two worlds probably will not intersect. It gives me a headache just to think about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The question is about the reference to a Japan case that comes at the beginning of Locked Rooms. Yes, I have intention of writing a book. It'll probably be one of those two-part books that has part of it set in Japan in the spring of 1924, the early summer of 1924, and part of it in 1925. So it'll probably be one of those cases that sort of stretches out. The reason that I didn't write it before is that I haven't been to Japan yet. So that's kind of a requirement. I'm going to Japan next spring. So probably that will be the next Russell, unless my editor's completely disruptive suggestion comes in the meantime. But we won't talk about that because it hasn't... I don't think about these things until I get home. Sir, yes. Yeah, over there.
So much like the first Holmes.
The question is about writing homes. How I managed to capture the original homes. I am glad you think I capture him. I'm never quite sure about that because there are certainly sections that are written by Holmes. The short story that's embedded into the middle of The Art of Detection and bits and pieces and a number of other books. And the one that's coming next year, the Fez book, which is called Garment of Shadows, that one has several sections of Holmes's voice too. I think that being allowed to develop him as a character because Conan Doyle was finished with him is the only way I can write that character. The fact that Conan Doyle, his last story, the last set story, is at the beginning of the Great War, so that when the Great War is on and when it ends, Holmes has disappeared. In Conan Doyle's mind, there's no place for that person in the England that existed after the war. So that I have this rich character within, you know, 60 stories of background that I can then allow to develop along very different lines because the country itself did. The huge, huge social changes that took place in Britain after 1914 mean that if Holmes is different, one would expect it. And his, you know, his being open to a relationship with this young woman is part of that change. I don't really try too hard to capture the precise voice of Holmes in Conan Doyle. I write, Holmes's voice is just slightly different from Russell's, but it's also very formal and quite English. So I think that the fact that really Russell is a young female Holmes means that they do share a lot of characteristics in outlook and in voice. So, yeah.
What can we expect from a study in Sherlock?
Oh, it's going to be fun. A Study in Sherlock is an anthology that Les Klinger and I put together. Les is the author of the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, the 3-volume, also the annotated Dracula. He is, I think, just after Christmas, the first volume of the annotated Sandman is coming out. And he's going to be doing the annotated, I can't remember. Anyway, so he and I were working on a couple of very academic-type books that the Baker Street Journal did. And in one of our conversations, we said, gee, it would be fun to do something that's actually got living authors in it. And we sort of looked at each other, and a little light went off, and we said, well, why not? Between us, we know 90% of the writers in the country. And so we put together a list of people who could write us a story inspired by the Sherlock Holmes canon, who were not known as Sherlockians. These are not people who write Sherlock Holmes pastiches, except for one, Neil Gaiman, who wrote a story that won the Hugo and some other prizes a few years ago. Neil did us a very different Sherlock Holmes story. Lee Child, super, super, very dark humor, quick little story, beautiful little thing. And, I mean, there's 18 writers. They're really great. If you're interested, it has its own website. But if you go onto my website and look at books, there's a list of all the books. You'll see the title, and it'll open it up into that page. But it's a really great series, a really great set of stories. And to our pleasure, Random House thinks that it's going to sell enough to justify a second volume. So we're now rubbing our hands and saying, oh, who can we ask for the second volume? So we have our list of names. And because Les and I, between us, know where most of the bodies are buried in this business, and he's a lawyer. very few people say no to us, so that's it. It comes out the end of October. I'm quite sure that the tattered cover will carry many, many copies of it. Now, would you like me to read you something from Fire King? Okay. Chapter 1. Honestly, Holmes, pirates? That is what I said. You want me to go and work for pirates? My dear Russell, someone your age should not be having trouble with her hearing. Sherlock Holmes, solicitous. Was Sherlock Holmes sarcastic? My dear Holmes, someone your age should not be overlooking incipient dementia. Why do you wish me to go and work for pirates? Think of it as an adventure, Russell. May I point out that this past year has been nothing but adventure? 10 back-to-back cases between us in the past 15 months stretched over, what, 8 countries? 10 if one acknowledges the independence of Scotland and Wales. What I need is a few weeks with nothing more demanding than my books. You should, of course, feel welcome to remain here. The words seemed to contain a weight beyond their surface meaning, a dark and inauspicious weight, a mariner's albatross sort of a weight. I replied with caution, "This being my home, I generally do feel welcome." Ah, did I not mention that Mycroft is coming to stay? Mycroft? Why on earth would Mycroft come here? In all the years I've lived in Sussex, he's visited only once. Twice, although the other occasion was while you were away. However, he's about to have the builders in, and he needs a quiet retreat. He can afford an hotel room. This is my brother, Russell, he chided. Yes, exactly, my husband's brother, Mycroft Holmes, whom I had thwarted blatantly with malice aforethought and with what promised to be heavy consequences scant weeks earlier, whose history I now knew held events that soured my attitude towards him, who wielded enormous, if invisible, power within the British government, and who was capable of making life uncomfortable for me until he had tamped me back down into my position of sister-in-law. How long? I asked. He thought 2 weeks. 14 days. 336 hours. 20,160 minutes. A first-hand opportunity to revenge himself on me verbally, psychologically, or surely not physically. Mycroft was a master of the subtlest of poisons. I speak metaphorically, of course. And 14 days would be plenty to work his vengeance and drive me to the edge of madness. And only the previous afternoon I had learnt that my alternate lodgings in Oxford had been flooded by a broken pipe, information that now crept forward in my mind, bringing a note of dour suspicion. No, Holmes was right. Best to be away if I could. Which circled the discussion around to its beginnings. Why should I wish to go work with pirates? I repeated. You would, of course, be undercover. Oh, naturally, with a cutlass between my teeth. I should think you would be more likely to wear a nightdress. A nightdress? Oh, this was getting better and better. As I remember, there are few parts for females among the pirates, although they may decide to place you among the support staff. Pirates have support staff. I set my teacup back into its saucer that I might lean forward and examine my husband's face. I could see no overt indications of lunacy, no more than usual. He ignored me, turning over a page of the letter he'd been reading, keeping it on his knee beneath the level of the table. I could not see the writing, which was, I thought, no accident. I should imagine they have a considerable number of personnel behind the scenes, he replied. Are we talking about pirates on the high seas, or piracy as violation of copyright law? Definitely the cutlass rather than the pen, although Gilbert might have argued for the literary element. Gilbert? 2 seconds later, the awful light of revelation flashed through my brain. At the same instant, Holmes tossed the letter onto the table so I could see its heading. Headings, plural. For the missive contained 2 separate letters folded together. The first was from Scotland Yard. The second was emblazoned with the words, Doily Cart Opera. I reared back, far more alarmed by the stationery than by the thought of climbing storm-tossed rigging in the company of cutthroats. Gilbert and Sullivan, I exclaimed. Pirates as in Penzance. Light opera and heavy humor. No, absolutely not. Whatever Inspector Lestrade has in mind, I refuse. One gathers, Holmes reflected, reaching for another slice of toast, that the title originally did hold a double entendre. Gilbert's dig at the habit of American companies to flout the niceties of British copyright law. He was not about to divert me by historical titbits or an insult against my American heritage. This was one threat against which my homeland would have to mount its own defense. You've dragged your sleeve in the butter. I got to my feet, picking up my half-emptied plate to underscore my refusal. It would not be a singing part, he said. I walked out of the room. He raised his voice. I would do it myself, but I need to be here from Mycroft to help him tidy up after the Goodman case. Answer gave I none. It shouldn't take you more than 2 weeks, three at the most. You'd probably find the solution before arriving in Lisbon. Why? I cut the question short. It did not matter in the least why the Doyle Card Opera Company wished me to go to Lisbon. I poked my head back into the room. Holmes? No. I have an entire academic year to catch up on. I have no interest whatsoever in the entertainment of hoi polloi. The entire thing sounds like a headache. I am not going to Lisbon or even London. I'm not going anywhere. No. Chapter 2. My steamer lurched into Lisbon on a horrible sleep.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.